Welcome to Insuring Crypto, a podcast where we talk about a healthy crypto space, from high utility tokens to emerging technologies. Let's insure crypto's future. Here's your host, Ensure CEO Mark Peters.
Hi, everyone. I'm Mark, CEO of Insure, coming to you today from Money 2020 in Las Vegas, Nevada. Welcome to Insuring Crypto. My guest today is Eric Bethel, who is about as passionate about crypto as anyone I have ever met. And I am very happy to get to spend some time with Eric and talk about his background today and what he thinks about the crypto world. Eric, very nice to have you today.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So, Eric, you know, I think I want to start today by talking about your background a little bit, and maybe you can share a little bit about yourself, maybe, you know, what you're doing for a living these days, or where you were born, married, kids,
etc. Sure. Glad to do that. I was born in Miami, Florida, to a career, a State Department civil servant diplomat, my father, and to a native of Havana, Cuba. So I'm a Cuban and an American, and I grew up in Miami. My family spent some time. We built a business publishing magazines for Latin American Airlines. So I spent a lot of my childhood jumping from place to place. In some cases, even as I grew older, writing articles for the magazine. So I, you know, spent most of my childhood in and around Latin America. And interestingly, I spent 10 years living in China, and more recently. And the firm that bought us moved me back here to Miami. So I've come sort of full circle. After high school, I didn't think I was going to come back to Miami other than through, you know, for Christmas and Thanksgiving and so forth. And here I am living, I don't know, maybe six blocks from the house I grew up in. Who would have thought?
That's wild. That's I actually, randomly enough, I was born and raised here in Las Vegas, and I never really thought I'd spend much time here again after I left, but it keeps pulling me back in different ways.
So my kids, my wife is American, as I am, and our kids were born in Shanghai. So when we moved here, it was a very interesting culture shock for them because we had them in a Mandarin-speaking school. So when they got here, particularly my oldest daughter, she had difficulty reading because all she knew was how to read Chinese characters. And cool. And so it was a very interesting childhood for them.
I can imagine that, yeah. Well, hopefully they've adjusted. Yeah. Well enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so I know you have quite a robust background and history in not just international finance, but, you know, working all over the world and your time at the World Bank. You know, maybe you can talk about some of your international, you know, experiences and escapades, whether it's crypto or not crypto related. I think our audience would love to hear it.
Yeah, sure. When I graduated from college and I started looking into what I was going to do, I went to the Naval Academy and I had to serve a number of years as a military officer. And after that period was over, I was trying to figure out what to do. And I found myself in a bit of a conundrum. I was trying to figure out what's my skill set, because I wanted one day to be an admiral. And that doesn't necessarily translate itself to the private sector. Well, I found myself in New York City, and I had bought a pair of shoes at Payless, and I bought a suit, and I went knocking door to door, and I ended up at Morgan Stanley, which was, funnily enough, I had a friend that was working there, and I thought it was a vacuum cleaner company, because I'd heard of Stanley Steamer, and my friend said, hey, you've got to come work for this company, Morgan Stanley, and, you know, you did really well at school, and, you know, perhaps you can do this. And I just naively said, sure. So I bought a suit and I showed up and I realized what it was late. You know, obviously, I'd spent quite a bit of time prepping for my interviews and so forth. But what's funny is I got the job because they said that I sort of looked like the part of a Wall Street banker, but I didn't know anything. And I spoke Spanish. Because I had grown up in and around Latin America and because my mom is Cuban, Spanish is my first language. And I speak Spanish well, natively well. And so I showed up and they said, you speak Spanish? And well, gosh, yeah. And you got good grades in college. Okay, that's the least of it. We're opening up a Latin America group and you're hired. I mean, it was more extensive than that, right? I mean, I went through a round of serious interviews, but at the end of the day, speaking Spanish got me the job. And then I spent the next 25 years doing finance in emerging markets, frontier markets, traditional, you know, Brazil, Mexico, you know, sort of larger emerging markets. And at some point along the way, I ended up in China, and I got an offer to work for a firm out there that was doing private equity. It was an American firm doing private equity in China. And I sort of landed in China as the window was closing for a foreigner who you know, didn't speak the language to go in. And I spent, you know, a good amount of time in China. And in that process, I created a firm that was linking China and Latin America, which was something that no one was thinking about in, say, 2016, 06 or 07. And I helped sort of spearhead an initiative, which ultimately culminated in us getting bought out and them bringing me back here. We were bought by a division of Franklin Templeton.
Oh, wow. Nice. So was that for infrastructure investments? What kind of investments was the team doing?
It was a combination of infrastructure, agribusiness, agriculture, timber, forestry, zinc mining, natural. It was basically what China needed. And China didn't win the, let's call it the geological lottery. There's not a lot of arable land that has with water in China. And that exists has a billion people living on it. And China doesn't have a lot of mineral wealth, you know, gold, they have rare earths, they've got coal, they have, but they're dramatically short of coal, vanadium, economically extractable sources of iron ore, soybeans, timber, trees, and Latin America had that. And so I created a business to link Latin America and China.
That's a wild path there. So it sounds like there probably has been some pretty big changes over the last decade or so in how the world's kind of working together. Maybe you want to talk about that a little bit in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, like, is the question you're asking is, you know, how has the world changed since? Yeah, I mean, look, thinking out loud, I would say that technology has been a democratizing influence. It used to take, for example, I don't know, 11 years to get a landline if you lived in most of Latin America. And those landlines rendered themselves useless when cell phones came out. And today you can basically get the entire body of human knowledge in a tablet, whereas in the past it required you walking 10, 15 miles to a country, you know, school somewhere with probably poor teachers, if the teacher showed up. So that's been a big change, technology writ large. But geopolitically, look, I mean, growing up, and I think in the beginning stages of my career, the biggest geopolitical threat was the Soviet Union. And when it collapsed, the general sentiment was like, look, liberal democracies and capitalism won. And now we need to remake the world in the Western mold. It was a, you know, a very optimistic time, and it was sort of the world of Francis Fukuyama, who wrote a book called The End of History. But in my opinion, there was a little bit of arrogance in that mindset. I think, you know, there were a lot of cultures around the world that wanted to develop, meaning they wanted to develop their infrastructure, their educational systems, their technology, but they didn't necessarily share our values. So we should have been a little bit more thoughtful and had a lot less hubris, and listen to Samuel Huntington, who wrote another book called The Clash of Civilizations, which painted a very different picture and called out the fact that, well, he called out the what later became the, and in the middle of my career became the Islamic terrorism threat, which of course, you know, the World Trade Center bombing recalibrated our thinking of the world. And you know, to the neocons, the neoconservative movement, it wasn't the Soviet Union that was the biggest threat to the world, but rather Islamic fundamentalism, and that of course led to our invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, places where we completely annihilated their militaries, but then we couldn't necessarily hold on to the governance system. And we ended up spending trillions creating a fantasy state in these countries, naively believing that we could promote Western democracies in places that had never voted ever. And over this period of time, while we were massively distracted our current geopolitical competitor, which is China, emerged.
Yep.
And it learned from a few things. It learned from the mistakes following the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And it while we were distracted, China burrowed into our ecosystem in the West, certainly in the United States, but also in Europe, right? It co-opted the chambers of commerce, hollowing out entire industries in the United States. It co-opted the Hollywood, the NBA, academic institutions, while promoting debt trap diplomacy around the world. So most of Africa owes a ballpark zillion dollars to China that they'll never be able to pay.
And that's the Belt and Road Initiative.
Belt and Road, yeah. And so that has been, I think, the single biggest change that we've seen, that I've seen. And it's a huge geopolitical threat for the United States and frankly, and the West, right? And we better get our game on because China wants to win. And there's really no limit to their ambition because they want everything. So this is a very, very serious thing. So this is sort of the evolution of how geopolitically things have changed. And, you know, it's always, you always have to recalibrate. So anyway.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. And the world, you know, world changes. Hopefully, you know, hopefully we can figure out a way to kind of move forward and definitely more of a united fashion, but understand the challenges to that from a overall society. You know, speaking of kind of a united worldwide structure, I know you've traveled around the world a lot. You mentioned this. You know, one of the things you were doing with the World Bank was I think you were setting up cryptos around the world in some of these potentially these African nations you're talking about. Maybe you can talk about. I listened to a really interesting kind of, I don't know if it was a TED Talk exactly, but it was exposition for the World Bank.
Yeah.
Where you talked about using crypto to solve some of these potential like corruption problems in different nations. I'd love to get, you know, you talking to you directly. I'd love to hear about that from you.
Yeah. So it wasn't crypto per se. What I was trying to do with the World Bank, let's understand what the World Bank does. The World Bank's job is to get people out of poverty. It was founded by the United States initially back in the 1940s to rebuild Europe after World War II. I think the first loan was to France. Over time, the World Bank morphed into what it is today, and it's a very large institution dedicated to getting people out of, and to making sure that you get people out of poverty without the senior people getting super rich and the poor people remaining poor, so that you distribute things evenly among people. To do this, the World Bank deploys tens of billions of dollars every year. Right? 60 billion, it's going to go to 100 billion soon. And it deploys capital everywhere in the cap structure. So the World Bank can invest in equity in a company in Ghana. It can provide a loan to the sovereign government of Mozambique. It can invest debt in companies. It has insurance companies and so forth. And one of the things that caught my attention was how to link technology into the World Bank's existing ecosystem. Technology writ large, whether it's artificial intelligence or blockchain-enabled loans and so forth. But for our purposes, we can talk about the blockchain, let's call it tokenized World Bank loans. So yeah. I had this idea that one of the ways to encourage good governance and transparency, you know, around the world was through the use of new and let's call it disruptive technologies. The way the World Bank works, and I'm oversimplifying, so let's assume that you want to build a road in a certain country, in a country in Africa or Latin America. You want to build the World Bank gives money in the form of a loan or a grant to a country to build a road. The general sort of, I usually use props, but I'll try and use my fingers. So the World Bank in Washington wires money to the central bank or the finance ministry of the country. The finance ministry then gives it to the infrastructure ministry. The infrastructure ministry hires a contractor, a GC, who hires a bunch of subcontractors. Along the way, money gets leaked. They call it leakage. Some of it is legit. It's going to consultants and middlemen in the system. Perhaps the general contractor, though, is a Chinese company, and there's quite a lot of leakage that takes place there. and then the subcontractors as well. And so ultimately, the people get short shrift of the situation because the road cost maybe twice as much as it should have. Certain, you know, contractors got very wealthy. Perhaps the brother-in-law of the prime minister got wealthy. And it's bad, right? It's bad for the people. And ultimately, it results in unsustainable debt loads. And again, I'm oversimplifying the problem. But what if you're able to, rather than wire dollars from point A to point B and, you know, take that train all the way to the end, what if you were able to create a token, a smart contract, if you will, between the World Bank and the finance ministry? And you blockchain enabled it so that, and you put it on a, let's call it a semi-public blockchain where the World Bank and the country could see it, but maybe no, maybe the IMF. And you could trace where the money goes, right? And it's immutable, it's transparent, and it promotes good governance, right? It keeps people honest. And so I began this process, and it was you know, a big learning process, because these are very complicated issues. If you think about crypto requires multidisciplinary thinking. You have to understand how decentralization works, the decentralization of ledgers. There's obviously a technology component to it. There's consensus. How does consensus work across disparate databases? You've got the immutability concept. You've got cryptography. You've got macroeconomic policy. These are super complicated things, and it took me a long time to understand them. And so I said, okay, I'm just going to start calling people and see if they'll take my calls. So I called up, you know, Vitalik Buterin and said, hey, do you want to come to the World Bank and explain to us how Ethereum works? And he goes, okay. And he showed up, and then I did the same thing with Ripple, with R3, with Stellar, with, you know, the IBM, you know, the Hyperledger folks. And I got to know a lot of people in the ecosystem, and it was really so that not just I could learn, but also some of my fellow board members could get informed, and also perhaps we can do good, right? We can take technology and we could do good in the world. That was really sort of the genesis of it all.
That's that's a great journey, right? And I mean, it sounds like you're extremely educated in the topic. So just to take a step back, you know, do you want to tell us a little bit about your time at the World Bank? It sounds like you were nominated to serve on the board.
Yeah, so I had left the firm I was working for. It was a financial firm. My no-compete had elapsed, and I was thinking about what to do next. And sitting around at home, probably driving my, you know, wife and kid crazy. And as it turned out, President Trump won the election. And through, you know, a series of relationships that I had developed over the years, I got a call one day asking if there was a possibility that I'd be interested in serving in some capacity. And I said, well, gosh, you know, I don't know. I don't know anything about government. And, you know, I'm a Republican, but I don't, I mean, what do I know? And why would anybody, you know, bring me on, you know, into the government? At the time, the world of government was very Byzantine. It was a black box. You saw people with titles. I didn't know what undersecretary versus deputy assistant secretary versus assistants. I mean, these were all very, you know, strange titles. I didn't know very much. And my friend said, hey, look, whenever a president comes into office, there are, I don't know, something like 4,000 positions for which you can apply. And, you know, there's obviously a vetting process. And, you know, it might be something you should consider. And I said, okay, why not, right? So the positions are, I guess, put in a book. It's called the Plum Book. Plum, because the original book had a sort of a plum color. It's still called the Plum Book, but now it's, you can just find it online. And it lists all of the positions that you can be nominated for. And so, and it was alphabetical, and it was an agriculture assistant secretary. I don't know anything about that. And so I went down the list. And honestly, I didn't feel that I was qualified for a lot of these positions because I didn't really know very much. And I saw one that I said, hey, wait, I can do this one. It's the world, right? And it's bank. I know finance, and I can, you know, I speak Chinese, I speak Spanish and Portuguese. So it's the intersection of geopolitics, finance, and how the United States can interplay in all of that. And I said, hey, I think I can do this. And then I, you know, started studying and making sure that I knew what I was doing, because it's a position that requires a Senate confirmation. And the last thing I want to do is to look like an idiot, permanently look like an idiot, because it's anything that's digitized.
On the record.
You live with it for the rest of your life. Your grandkids are going to see you looking stupid, right? Because it's there forever. And so I studied, I went through the various hoops of meeting the right folks in government. There's something called the Presidential Personnel Office, which is like the HR of the White House. And I was, vetted in every way, including the FBI, calling my neighbors, knocking on their door, which was a little frightening, frankly, because my wife was getting text messages from the neighbors wondering if I was in trouble because the FBI was, asking about me. And they interviewed my nanny, and I have a nanny she's Honduran, but she's an American citizen. I pay her taxes, I pay her Social Security. So it's like, whew, dodged a bullet there. And the next thing I know, I'm sitting in front of a bunch of senators. It's obviously very daunting. You've got your wife and your kids behind you, and your 80-year-old, Cuban mom, kind of rooting for you, and you're hoping not to say anything stupid. But I think the general consensus was that I was competent. I knew what I was doing, and then I would represent the U.S. faithfully and with transparency and integrity. And they said, all right, you're good to go. And I got the nod. I was voted out of committee. I went to the full Senate floor, and I was 100-0 to be the your representative at the World Bank.
That's awesome. That's probably a rare feat. Thank you for serving for us.
Yeah.
Hey, listeners, I have to interrupt here. This is such a good conversation, we decided to break this into two parts. Please click below for part two.
Thank you for listening. We'd love for you to follow us on your favorite podcast player, and don't forget to leave a review.